for this extremely generous introduction. I'm delighted to be a part of this Ringvorlesung. By the way, I'm not quite sure what Ringvorlesung would translate as in English. Circulating lecture, maybe, like a circulating library. You get introduced to many, many different approaches, and I'll do my very best to introduce you to more recent approaches in Shakespeare studies today. Not only that, I'm going to try to introduce recent developments that go beyond the new historicism, and I'm also going to suggest a research strategy to you which places the plays in a media historical perspective. I'll try to introduce you to anthropological and ecological ways of theorizing media, understanding media and media formations as cultural and institutional settings that are shaped by human beings and their natural and cultural environments, and which also themselves shape the ways in which we can define terms like nature, culture, or the human. For this perspective, Shakespeare can serve as a good case study, because Shakespeare is an example that demonstrates both the continuity of media orientations and their ongoing transformations. His plays both belong to the early modern period. In fact, for some people, early modern studies are almost synonymous with Shakespeare studies. They belong to the early modern period and to the present, which continually revisits and restages them in different forms and different media, reiterating the view expressed by the Polish scholar Jan Kott in the 1960s that Shakespeare is our contemporary. Both isolating Shakespeare in his own historical moment, whatever that may mean, and transposing him into a modern or even postmodern cultural figure is potentially hazardous and damaging for Shakespeare studies. In the words of Andrew Hatfield, quote, "Shakespeare has become part of our intellectual furniture, so much so that his presence can serve to preclude thought, to prevent thought, rather than to encourage it," unquote. In the balance between performative theatricality and literary complexity, Shakespeare's plays explore and exploit to the full the potentials and limits of early modern theatrical culture. I will argue that while the plays were perfectly suited to the theatrical conditions of their own time, Shakespeare's way of handling these conditions prepared his work for very different modern media configurations that he could in no way foresee or anticipate. In this, they are indeed not for an age, but for all time, as Ben Jonson wrote in a poem included in the first folio of Shakespeare's plays in 1623. Recent literary and cultural theories, first and foremost new historicism and cultural materialism, have registered a yearning for speaking with the dead and the touch of the real, a utopian desire for historical authenticity, for gaining access to the lived reality of past worlds. On the other hand, the cooler modes of modern theory, such as deconstruction, radical constructivism, and systems theory, alert us to the fact that the past is either a foreign country, a distant mirror, or a construction motivated by the interests of the present, for example, by political interests. As you've learned in the lecture by Ute Berns, new historicism and cultural materialism are characterized by a desire for presence, on the one hand, and by an emancipatory political or ideological agenda, on the other hand. So there is a paradox between the hot desire for seeing the past as another present and the clear, cold eye of contemporary theories that teach us that this is either impossible or that such access to the past is only possible at the price of politically motivated selections and perhaps distortions of historical evidence. A question I want to explore today is whether a media-based approach to the study of culture can possibly constitute a third way between the pitfalls or pratfalls of hardcore constructivist or systems theoretical distancing, on the one hand, and the new historicist fetish of closeness, of touching the material concreteness embodied in cultural objects and texts, on the other hand. The motivation for this approach is not, at least at first sight, not explicitly political. I have nothing to preach. If asked for a personal motivation, I would say that what I want to do is convey some of the fascination that certain cultural objects and experiences can potentially transport across great divides of time and space, but also to question the presentism, the almost exclusive focus on current social and political interests and debates that looms large in contemporary literary and cultural theory. To some extent, there is no way around the constant remaking of something like Shakespeare in our own image. But there is also a moment of resistance to such reconstruction in these texts, something that cannot be assimilated, cannot be made to fit our own agendas and interests. And it is this remainder of strangeness and incommensurability inherent in texts and other media from the past that I wish to make you aware of. So I do not want to queer you, as Nadine Stritzke so admirably did last week. There she is. Even though some aspects of gender will return in my presentation. Maybe I want to Shakesqueer you, if that pun is allowed. Be that as it may, I think that theory, if used in the right way, can help you to understand both the singularity of the past and its inevitable restructuring for the purposes of the present moment, right? Both the singularity of the past and its inevitable restructuring for present purposes. As you can see on your handout, which I hope everyone received on the way in, my lecture is in three main parts. I will speak about recent developments in Shakespeare studies after the new historicism. Actually, there are four parts now. I changed this around a little bit. Recent developments in Shakespeare studies after the new historicism. Then I will introduce you to concepts of theatricality and media ecology using the example of dress and costumes. And finally, I'll briefly speak about Shakespeare's imagery and the double vulnerability of representation and performance, both of which can be accessed, my suggestion is, through a media ecological perspective. A hallmark of Shakespeare's art is the tension between performance and reflection, or between representation and suspended representation. These tensions can be maintained to some extent also under modern theatrical conditions, but perhaps paradoxically, they may be preserved even better in the medium of film. In fact, it has been argued that especially in the later plays, Shakespeare shows some skepticism about the medium of theatre, which is barely able to sustain the audience's participation and involvement required by the complexities of the text and by the deficiencies of stage illusion. This weakness of theatrical illusion and the dependency on the audience's willingness to use their imagination to complete the missing elements in a stage performance is famously illustrated in the prologue to Henry V, in which the audience is asked to, quote, "piece out our imperfections with your thoughts, into 1,000 parts divide one man, and make imaginary puissance. Think when we talk of horses that you see them. Think when we talk of horses that you see them." Rather than presenting static images of life, staged life, Shakespeare's plays make their images real or partly real in public performance by reinforcing the audience's imagination with the aid of speech and with the physical movement of bodies and objects on stage. The result is not staged life, a representation of a given reality beyond the stage, but stage life, a mode of being that is unique to the theatrical space. In this lecture, I will try to develop a media perspective that may help you to see how this effect comes about and to understand both Shakespeare's uniqueness and his universality. Uniqueness and universality. Maybe you could see this better if I dim the lights a little bit. Like this? Okay. Over the past decades, the image we have of Shakespeare has changed in multiple ways. From that of the solitary individual genius who never blotted line, Ben Jonson, to that of the actor, sharer, and housekeeper, that is, part owner, of a theatre company in one of the most competitive and interesting periods in English theatre history. Shakespeare, who had neither a university education nor an aristocratic family background, is one of very few early modern writers who can be considered self-made men. His attitude towards his work was probably very professional. When he finally retired to rural Stratford after some 20 years of working for the stage in London, a moderately wealthy man, he apparently stopped writing and lost interest in the theatre. Maybe he's a case for Professor Horstmann, who recently published a book on writers who stop writing and what that means and what that does to them. We don't know. He apparently stopped writing and lost interest in the theatre, as far as we can tell. Since he was deeply involved with the acting company, his situations of writing would have taken many forms for many different occasions. Writing and rewriting play scripts, often in collaboration with others, adapting old and new plays for different contexts, for instance, for performances at court or on tour, writing poetry for potential aristocratic patrons, allowing these poems to circulate in manuscript among friends, and possibly seeing them through the printing press. This is not the work of a solitary genius, but of a company writer. Shakespeare never owned the rights of the plays we call his. Indeed, a concept of author's rights was not extant in that period. As far as we know, he did not care much about seeing his plays printed in a collected edition of reliable authorial texts. When Ben Jonson, his friend and competitor, when Jonson included plays in his works of 1616, he was ridiculed. Plays were a much less prestigious genre than poetry. The publication of the first folio, 7 years after Shakespeare's death, was organized by two of his former colleagues, John Hemmings and Henry Condell, probably to prevent other printer publishers from cashing in on the popular repertoire of the King's Men. Even though in recent years a strong case has been made for Shakespeare as a literary dramatist who wrote for the page as well as for the stage, the more common opinion is still that Shakespeare, quote, never showed the least bit of interest in being a dramatic author while he lived, unquote. What, if anything, he may care about in the afterlife is a different story. But what has changed is not only our appreciation of early modern print culture and scribal publication, that is, manuscript publication. Our knowledge of the Shakespearean stage and historical practices of performance has grown immensely through the work of theatre historians and archaeologists, but also actors and directors who are trying to reconstruct the original practices of Shakespeare's theatre. Parts of the Rose and the Globe Theatre have been excavated from 1989 onwards, and visitors to London can now, since 1996, go to watch a play at the so-called Shakespeare's Globe, a reconstruction of Shakespeare's most famous workplace on the South Bank, slightly closer to the river than the original building. The question is whether these practices of reconstruction, in trying or pretending to bring us closer to the historical reality of Shakespeare, provide a genuine new source of information through practical experiment, or whether they merely add another layer to the historical confusion. There is much that can be learned from staging the plays in a presumably near-authentic physical space, but this knowledge needs to be complemented by an awareness of the unsettled questions, and there are many. What is more, there is something of a paradox in these attempts to reconstruct as precisely as possible a particular playhouse, which, as the experts say, quoting Andrew Gurr, the Globe never deserved that unique status, unquote, because from 1595 onwards, the smaller indoor playhouse of the Blackfriars seems to have been the company's preferred, because more profitable, location. Early modern playwrights, and Shakespeare was no exception in this respect, had to produce plays that were portable, plays that could be taken on tour and adapted to many different locations, outdoors and indoors alike, from inn yards to larger or smaller halls. Shakespeare and his fellow actors performed at the Globe, at the Blackfriars, but also at the Middle Temple or in the Banqueting Hall at Whitehall. This very adaptability and independence of a particular space or time has certainly helped to make Shakespeare a lasting global phenomenon. The plays have a timeless but also spaceless quality. They can be made to work on a small bare stage as well as in a large amphitheater or on the big screen. It's certainly worthwhile to continue researching the specific historical moment of Shakespeare. Yet there are cultural developments that, like Shakespeare himself, do not seem to care in the least for historical accuracy and continue the multimedia appeal of Shakespeare in film, TV, and popular culture, an appeal that somehow seems to have been there from the very beginning. His plays can work in any environment, including the virtual environment of Second Life. But perhaps the specificity of Shakespeare's historical theatrical conditions and practices can tell us something to explain the universality of the plays. For this reason, I turn to the historical media ecology in which and with which Shakespeare worked. His historical situatedness and saturation in different situations of writing and performance, in order to find out more about the durability of Shakespeare in modern media. The term media ecology needs some explanation. Both the term media and the term ecology can carry multiple meanings. In modern sociology, the term media ecology or information ecology is sometimes used to describe the data management and workflow in organizations and the interactions between information technology and its users. In another sense that is closer to the environmentalist meaning of ecology, cultural anthropologists sometimes use the term media ecology to study human culture against the changing background of technological media, from speech and writing, orality versus literacy, to audio-visual technologies, computers, and the internet. Critics and scholars writing in this tradition include Harold Innes, Marshall McLuhan, Lewis Mumford, Walter J. Ong, and Neil Postman, the Toronto School and the New York School of North American Media Studies. In this view, basic anthropological orientations remain more or less stable over long periods of time, whereas their cultural actualizations come and go with the short-term innovations of technological media. Media are notoriously difficult to define. Definitions range from the most specific to the most basic, from modern communications networks or mass media to material objects that can preserve different forms, from the silicium wafer to the sand that takes your footprint. One of the most influential definitions of media has been given by Canadian scholar Marshall McLuhan in the 1960s. Media, he writes, are extensions of man. Extensions of man. How human these extensions of man remain is a question over which critics are deeply divided, especially since German media studies led by Friedrich Kittler propagated die Austreibung des Geistes aus den Geisteswissenschaften, the expulsion of the spirit from the humanities, in the 1980s, long before the Bologna reforms, which of course did it much more efficiently. For Kittler, there is no software, and human beings are extensions of media, not the other way around. Are media extensions of man, or are human beings extensions of media? Post-structuralist critics like Kittler, N. Catherine Hales, or Joseph Tabby have expanded the traditional humanist focus of media ecology towards contemporary science and science studies, including the history and philosophy of science, as well as cybernetics and computer studies. Marshall McLuhan's extensions theorem may be too focused on a view of media as mere tools rather than as formative and potentially total environments in which we live. Nowadays, we are surrounded by and involved in many different layers of mediality or mediation, from the internet to the iPod. And the metaphor of the network is taking over from the earlier view of man as the tool-making animal. Men and women may be, more than anything else, media-making and media-using animals. This is why in recent years media anthropology has become a growing field in the study of culture, next to studies of technoculture, cognition, and brain research. Nowadays, we may be better served by a perspective that looks at media not so much as tools or extensions, but as environments. Such a view will be less anthropocentric and more favorable to the idea that media, much as we may create and use them, also partly shape who and what we are, a perspective of intermediality that is characterized by the coexistence of bodies, technologies, and different types of content, or in the terms preferred by computer nerds, the coexistence and fusion of hardware, software, and wetware. To take the step from media anthropology to media ecology is to acknowledge the increasing relevance of space and location in media and cultural studies, as well as the importance of the network concept with its implications of multi-level interconnectedness between different objects, different types of objects, and subjects. Following the work of the American psychologist Gregory Bateson on the ecology of mind, a book published in 1972, in which Bateson, a pioneer of ecological and cybernetic thinking in the humanities, delineates an ecologically integrated perspective on human behavior and its pathologies, such as alcoholism and schizophrenia, media ecology studies the interdependence, the interdependencies of living systems and their media environments. In this perspective, life among media, as Matthew Fuller argues, following the French psychologist and philosopher Félix Guattari, has to be considered in political, ethical, and aesthetic terms, linking mental, natural, and social modes of ecology. In order to maintain theoretical flexibility and freedom of movement, it may be helpful to avoid definitions that are too systematic. The aim of media ecology is not to arrive at a grand unified theory, but a theoretical toolbox that allows us to work with what we find around us. This is why I won't or even cannot attempt to give you a hard and fast definition of media or medium, even though, in analogy to Niklas Luhmann's first principle in systems theory, es gibt Systeme, there are systems, one could perhaps say es gibt Medien, there are media. This first principle allows me to evade or avoid an all too easily objectified account of media, which would be limited to mass media as concrete and more or less standardized objects, newspapers, TV, cinema, the internet, etc., or, in the words of Matthew Fuller, quote, as a sustainable mode of economy and nameable cultural presence, unquote. Instead, it allows me to focus on media configurations that are dynamic and flexible and that always include us as performers, producers, or recipients in an actor network. Rather than studying media as objects, we become interested in processes of mediation or medialization. In the question as formulated by Ludwig Pfeiffer, quote, which medial aspects of a so-called medium, and not only those aspects that can be described in terms of form or content, have a tangible impact in the context of dynamic cultural media configurations? My translation from the German original. In German, welche medialen, nicht nur inhaltlich oder formal beschreibbaren Aspekte eines sogenannten Mediums, spürbare Wirkungen im Kontext dynamischer kultureller Medienkonfigurationen entfalten? This is the big question. But perhaps it's not clear where all these theoretical reflections lead to. What should be clear, however, is that when we try to talk about Shakespeare from a perspective of media ecology, we're interested in the connections between life and media. For Shakespeare, these connections become interesting, intensely fascinating, and ultimately problematic in the context of late 16th, early 17th century English theatrical culture. Stage life, life on stage, is more than merely staged life. New historicist Stephen Greenblatt has taught us to see that there is a process of exchanges or negotiations going on between what happens in the plays on stage and the social energy that circulates in the reality around the stage. This mutual feedback is very important. In the Shakespearean cultural moment, stage life is literally thrust off the thrust stage into the eyes and ears of the audience. What the two main performance locations of Jacobean London had in common was that both the amphitheatre and the indoor hall theatre allowed a close contact and indeed a dialogic or polylogic exchange between players and their audience. In the words of Jacqueline Royce, the Globe provided the actor, quote, with a stage large enough to allow for freedom of movement, yet small enough and close enough to the audience to highlight discrete details of body language, including, unquote, including perhaps surprisingly, small gestures and facial expressions. The face was expected to be the actor's chief visual medium of communication in both comedy and tragedy, as John Astington asserts. The audience becomes immersed in the action visually as well as verbally. What this means for Shakespeare's original aesthetics is summed up very neatly by Andrew Gurr. Long quote. A stage bare, except for the colorfully dressed players and occasional tables or beds, could never have been entirely dependent on passively receptive audiences and passive emotions. Audiences, being in full daylight and fully visible to the players, had to be addressed directly. Soliloquies were never just private musings, but confidences spoken like asides directly to the visible hearers. Crammed closely together, and as visible to one another as to the players, audiences behaved not as individuals, but as a crowd. The collective emotion of crowds in public events are felt and heard inescapably. Inside the Globe, the feelings of players and their audiences were an interactive process. Visible crowds could openly register their feelings about the stories they witnessed, unquote. for green blood and the new historicists, this circulation, this interaction, circulation of social energy takes place predominantly, if not exclusively, through words and discourse. A more media-conscious route is followed by the new materialists who, for example, explore the concrete physical objects used as stage props or the cognitive networks established by material objects and their cultural functions, for example, mirrors, books, clocks, maps, and letters, as they are used in Shakespeare's plays. But the focus on objects alone does not necessarily result in objectivity. Other criteria of interpretation are needed. Thus, there is a hermeneutic gap, a gap of interpretation, between claims to understand Shakespeare historically through objects and the actual interpretations of Shakespeare's plays that are mediated through these objects. The new materialism insists on the referential dimensions of Shakespeare's plays in including and pointing to material objects. But these referential dimensions cannot be exhausted by objects. They still require interpretation. They require, in my view, a more differentiated, networked, ecological perspective on objects, texts, and performances in media environments. A perspective that focuses on the interrelations between social and aesthetic energies. In this view, what happens on stage is not merely an encounter of many different discourses, what Jürgen Link has called interdiscursivity, but the emergence of a special kind of space that is simultaneously inside and outside of discourses, a space of mere play or pure performativity, subtended by the social and psychocultural imaginary on which it feeds and into which it can then feed back. What I call aesthetic here should not be confused with the elusive concepts of art in traditional aesthetics or philosophies of art. Rather, the version of media ecology that I'm presenting is based on a view of the aesthetic as an anthropological potential of shaping the imaginary, based on the explorations of Cornelius Castoriadis, Wolfgang Iser, and Ludwig Pfeiffer. The basic assumption is that human beings need media if and when they want to capture, to make available for communication, their experience of the world in its manifold dimensions, physical, affective, emotional, cognitive, and social. This perspective hinges on the concept of cultural performativity as opposed to representation, on the idea that culture is not something given, but something that emerges in and through enactment, a form of becoming rather than being. And the fact that the main new historicist journal is called Representations rather than Performances may already be an indication of the difference in direction that I'm trying to go here in contrast or in opposition to parts of new historicism. This perspective hinges, as I say, on a concept of cultural performativity as opposed to representation. It necessarily distances itself from compartmentalized histories of individual media, like the history of theater, the history of the novel, or art forms, like art history, music history, and so on. On the contrary, it proceeds from the assumption that literature and other manifestations of the imaginary contain or depend on more than one single medium. For this reason, media anthropology and media ecology prefer to speak of sociocultural, technological, and psychic processes of medialization rather than of media as instruments or objects. This is not easy, and partly it's contrary to our common sense habits of thinking. We're used to looking at objects, but we fail to see the cultural and social networks that surround, condition, and historicize objects or media. A good example of this process of medialization is dress. Here I need to revisit briefly Ute Bern's very enlightening comments on the function of costumes and the transfer processes between social and religious institutions and the theater, what Stephen Greenblatt calls transmigration, a material transfer, clothes wander from one institution to the other, a material transfer that can be interpreted as an act of symbolic appropriation or even occasionally symbolic aggression. Costume on stage does not have the same functions and meanings that dress has offstage. It can obviously represent, simulate offstage functions and meanings, like having a bishop on stage who is dressed like a bishop in real life. But it can do more. It can expose the theatrical, performative potential of dress in everyday life, the idea that the clothes make the man. Even more so in Shakespeare's time, when the so-called sumptuary laws dictated what people from a certain rank, social rank, were allowed to or forbidden to wear, and when actors would regularly use actual clothes that noblemen and women had discarded, presented as gifts to their servants who were not allowed to wear them, but who would sell them at a decent price to the acting companies. The companies would spend more money on costumes than they paid for a new play script. One effect of this theatricalization of clothes is that audiences would see actors on stage in exactly the same piece of clothing, a cloak or a hat, that a high-ranking statesman might have worn just a few months or weeks ago, suggesting the performative potential of clothes for self-fashioning and the tenuous distinction between staged life and stage life. Since dress, medialized as costume, could function as another potential blurring of the line between theater and city life, it is no wonder that it contributed to the fears of Puritans and city officials who continuously attacked the theater as a site of indecency that endangered civic morality and public health. But costume can also function as a purely theatrical means of performative transformation. In new historicism and cultural materialism, there is a tendency to read costume in its symbolic function too quickly and superficially as a sign of something else, an institutional or social referent. In other words, there is a tendency to neglect the sheer theatricality of costume. As Peter Hyland argues, studies that focus primarily on the subject of cross-dressing in Shakespeare, this is where the gender aspect comes in, studies that focus primarily on the subject of cross-dressing, quote, minimize the very theatricality of disguise by looking through disguise in search of cultural meanings, unquote. And this is why Robert Weimann and Douglas Brewster suggest to, quote, take cross-dressing and disguise as a highly performative medium in its own right, a medium in its own right, which conjoins the writings of the dramatist to peculiar, arresting productions of actors' bodies and voices, unquote. Costumes and their uses in the histrionic exuberance of multiple shape-changing are thus seen to function, again a quote from Weimann and Brewster, function as a mixed site for the conjuncture of two media which cannot be reduced to the status of representation as an imaginary and ideological form of challenge, struggle, or difference, unquote. This means that disguise and cross-dressing in particular, disguise of gender, function as a catalyst for almost uncontrolled transformation, a mode that in performance not merely simulates social communication, that is, repeats and endorses the dominant ideologies of its time, but that occasionally questions and subverts the authority of hegemonic ideologies and values, and that occasionally offers possibilities for mere play without any referential or symbolic value. I would have to look at more concrete examples in detail, but there is, I think, too little time. For case studies of this if you're interested in this performative or performance-oriented approach to Shakespeare, I can recommend the recent book by Robert Weimann and Douglas Brewster, which is should be on the handout in the bibliography, Shakespeare and the Power of Performance. This book also presents a kind of summa of the work of one of the best, I think, one of the best German, former East German Shakespeare scholars of today, Robert Weimann. It is one of the ironies of cultural history that the so-called foul papers, rough copies written for stage production, of someone who did not even claim the status of an author, should for successive generations become a springboard for exploring complexities of language and thought that many have deemed unfit for the relative banality and crudeness of stage performance. But in the original conditions, in what I've called the media ecology of Shakespeare's England, this combination of entertainment and sophistication is not a contradiction, but a fusion made possible by a relatively stable political context on the one hand, and a time of rapid socio-cultural and economic expansion on the other hand. As we've seen in the case of dress, strict codes applied that fixed a person's human status as social status, in principle. But this status also had to be continuously adapted, negotiated, or fashioned in changing situations. So you have strict codes and norms on the one hand, but on the other hand, you have the individual need or necessity to transgress these codes at certain times and occasions. These conditions of dynamic change and remainders of static traditional expectations allow Shakespeare to play out the tensions between the social and gender roles of characters and their imaginative projections of themselves, from Macbeth's imaginary visualization of the dagger to the complicated gender role play in many of the comedies. In its staging of transformations, Elizabethan and Jacobean theatre productively tackles the ancient fear concerning the extent to which the images of the imagination are simulations of the real, or effectively, performatively producing realities. Right? Are they to what extent are they representations of a given reality, or the performative enactment of something new? In other words, modes of life on stage. Rather than presenting static images of staged life, Shakespeare's plays make their images partly real in public performance, right? By reinforcing the imagination and producing not staged life, but stage life. So how does Shakespeare do this? How does Shakespeare stage life, and what is the media appeal of this staging? On the one hand, his language contains many suggestive and concrete images of order. On the other hand, the compulsion towards action in situations of change makes continuous adjustments necessary. For instance, the traditional image of the Wheel of Fortune is a crucial image, especially in Shakespeare's history plays. This is transformed from a fairly static image into what Abi Warburg called a symbol of energy, a symbol of energy. You can take Antonio in The Merchant of Venice as an example. Antonio is despondent, although blessed by fortune in the sense of prosperity, because he has to deal with a new kind of fortune. He's a merchant adventurer who runs risks with ships at sea. And even Hamlet, who thinks about suicide because of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, who therefore doesn't do what he's supposed to do, Hamlet does all other kinds of things, surprising things, sudden and cruel things, like tormenting Ophelia immediately after his suicide soliloquy. Sometimes the theatricality of the images used is extremely powerful, especially if it can also be conveyed by the actor's movement on stage. For instance, Northumberland at the beginning of the second part of Henry IV, Northumberland says, "Contention like a horse, full of high feeding, madly hath broke loose and bears down all before him. A very dynamic image in which a different type of fortune is suggested. The unceasing self-generation of challenging situations in which people must both act and think a lot. So, combining language and performance, the media effect of theatricality is characterized by both involvement and distance with regard to the audience. The fluidity of social energies in Shakespeare's age and the media conditions of his time contribute to a unique dramatic pattern which has proved, to say the least, its long-term cultural appeal or attraction. Shakespeare's theater mediates between direct, concrete, or primary dramatic illusion and various forms and levels of abstracting from and sometimes destroying illusion, right? Both involvement and distancing, you could say. In this process, the audience was much more involved than today because of the less clear separation between stage and audience space. The stage, in other words, was dominated by performance on the one hand and its suspension on the other hand, and the audience was basically forced to go along. Shakespeare suspends representation by establishing discrepant levels of awareness, both between the characters on stage and between characters and audience. By involving the audience in the performance, the acting out of a transformational potential of human nature could be effective because this potential provided a crucial link between life on stage and life beyond the stage. Life on stage could transform the attractions and risks of change and transformation into dynamic and meaningful shapes. Hence, the notorious metaphor of the world as a stage from As You Like It does not mean that the world and the stage are identical, of course, but that there is a spectrum of affinities which links the two and turns theater into the medium of the early modern period. To radicalize this perspective a little further, one could say that Shakespeare's plays, more perhaps than any others, oscillate between the impossibility or absurdity of straightforward representation and pure play, that is, the loss of any identifiable core of representation. In order to exploit the potentials and shortcomings of the media configuration of theatre, Shakespeare transposes everything that enters his plays into multiple and multifunctional forms: characters, language, actions, generic forms and conventions, historic events, even stage properties. This is what James Calderwood has called metadrama. Metadrama, drama as both a form and an anti-form, in which the boundaries between art and life are not abolished, but continuously dissolved and precariously re-established. This is scholarly work already from the 1970s, so it's not something really radically new. Even as simple an object as a chair can be transformed when a character stares at it for a long time very intensely, as Macbeth does. He sees the ghost of Banquo in a chair in Act 3, Scene 4. Puck is sometimes taken for a chair in Midsummer Night's Dream, and so on. Shakespeare also has many of his characters say very skeptical things about theatre, however. For instance, Duke Theseus at the end of Midsummer Night's Dream, as a very conventional closing statement about lovers, madmen, and play acting, which you could look at, which is very skeptical about the potential of theatre, because the transformations that you see on stage are rarely really breathtaking. The awareness that you're merely watching a play cannot be dispersed. And perhaps this is why Shakespeare continually takes up that problem and tells the audience that he knows about this, and he's still able to turn this into a fascinating theatrical situation. A play tends to be either bound by representational constraints or fall into empty acting. Shakespeare is therefore much more aware than later, more conventional playwrights, that his plays depend for their effectiveness on a very active imaginative participation, right? This was my starting point, the active participation of the audience, which becomes evident, for instance, in the prologue to Henry V. Now, this necessity, this need for an imaginatively active or activated audience as part of the media ecology of Shakespeare's drama becomes more urgent, more pressing, to the degree that the representational core of a play itself is trivial or problematic. And Henry V is a case in point, because in Henry V, the audience is strongly encouraged by a chorus before each act to imagine all kinds of things, because in itself, the story of how Henry V defeated the French does not look quite so glorious and captivating. As a mere represented story, the play cannot suppress the question whether the so-called French conquests of long ago, they had been already lost again in Shakespeare's time, whether these conquests are really worth the sacrifice of so many soldiers' lives. In the theatrical production, in which the audience is asked to imagine only a selection of things, but these very vividly, that question can be effectively swept under the rug. This is also why the history plays offer a particularly good case in point for this problem of representation and theatricality. This is now my final case study. In a sense, the two parts of Henry IV, a very long play that can hardly be performed in one session, signal a certain farewell of Shakespeare to the theatre as a medium for the representation and performance of history. In a very literal sense, history can no longer be embodied and therefore displayed on stage anymore. That is, the bodies of the actors and their extensions, clothes, weapons, jewelry, posture, movement, this elementary medium of drama, the presence of living bodies and their suggestive interaction, no longer occupy definite spaces in a political world which is dominated by strategic thinking and acting, power play, which has become much more abstract and, in fact, partly invisible. So you can no longer embody these things and represent them on stage. The theater can show individual acts or actions of the characters, but it runs into difficulties in suggesting either the fascination or the logic of political action in the sense of tactics and strategies. Just one very simple example. In the Battle of Shrewsbury, Henry IV sends some nobleman dressed up as himself, that is, dressed as the king, into the field in order to confuse the enemies. With this, he breaks up the old type of chivalric man-to-man combat. So this is just a trick, right? And at the end of the second part of that play, the decisive battle is not fought at all anymore, but the victory is reached by a very mean rhetorical trick, the so-called gall tree stratagem, and later Prince John says cynically, quote, "God and not we hath safely fought today," unquote. Drama has to concentrate, obviously, on dramatic face-to-face communication and action, but that type does not characterize historical political action anymore. And nothing makes this clearer than the allegorical figure of rumor, which introduces the second part of Henry IV. You have rumor appeared on stage, dressed in an interesting costume, painted over with tongues, zungen. So rumor comes in many voices, obviously, and is unreliable in that sense. If rumor turns into a crucial medium of reality construction and manipulation, the reality of the play cannot consist in the dramatic enactment of moral or political struggles for some kind of order, but rather in superior, more successful techniques of collecting or manipulating information. And such techniques do not rely on the evidence of the senses, of appearances, however powerful they may performatively be. There's a continuous blend of conjectures, expectations, of expectations, suspicions of organizational problems and even military espionage. The reality of the play does not emerge from body-based performance or embodiments as the fusion of bodies and meanings. That reality, if you still want to call it that, is hidden in a continuous challenge of information management, and risk control. Shakespeare always exploits the ambiguous relationship of performing, interacting persons and language. This is why puns and wordplay have such a prominent place in all his plays. Now, however, interaction, performatively playing out the relationships between people, hardly plays a role anymore. History then has become far too complex for theatrical performative representation. It becomes either more or less invisible, or it turns into an ideological construct if it is supposed to have some meaning. Now, this is indeed the significance of the character of Falstaff in the history plays, and especially Henry IV. Because for a while, if only for a while, the character of Falstaff, Falstaff seems to embody something like total theatricality. He can keep the upper hand and keep the play alive as a play. Because from Falstaff's theatrical perspective, Falstaff can play everything, including the king, as you will see in a minute. From his point of view, the aristocratic political world, England itself, are as insubstantial as the superstitions of some credulous persons. Falstaff thus is divorced from the play as an illusion of historical life. He's committed not to the play as a representation of history, but to the play as absolute play. Ideological representation and pure theatricality are opposed to each other. Falstaff cannot take the doings of kings and rebels seriously anymore. He looks at everything with a detachment of radical humor. Everyone he meets in the play, he transforms immediately into an audience. He is the embodiment of pure theatricality. And this is quite well illustrated in the clip that I'm going to show you now. This is Orson Welles' performance of Falstaff in his film version. This is not just a film of Henry IV, but really a version of the entire Henriad, using texts from many of Shakespeare's history plays, including also the comedy The Merry Wives of Windsor. Because in this film, Welles kind of draws the conclusion from this and turns Falstaff into the central protagonist. The film follows the trajectory of this character. This is called Chimes at Midnight. If you've never seen it, it's very worth seeing, but it's hard to get the DVD. I had to buy this in Spain, of all places. And all the extra material on the DVD is in Spanish. Anyway, this is... one clip, one extract, so you get an idea of Falstaff's theatricality here, where he plays the king. Okay, this scene, I showed this scene in order to illustrate how the how you can translate Shakespearean metadrama from stage to film, right, including a kind of historical reference to audience and the audience both response and interaction with what goes on this kind of improvised stage in this hall, right? But of course, also to illustrate Falstaff's role in the Henry plays as kind of literally the embodiment of theater, which here is captured quite well also with the sheer physicality of Welles's use of his body and his obesity in order to play the character of Falstaff. Actually, if you think, if you go to the records, historical records, and look at the original actor who probably was the first to perform Falstaff, a man named William Kemp, who was the clown of Shakespeare's troupe of actors. William Kemp was a very athletic and rather slender person who probably used a cushion or two cushions or so to embody the character of Falstaff. So you need a lot of you need an actor who is physically capable of doing this capering around on the stage. The second clip shows a different aspect of Falstaff, again from Wells's now classic performance. This is the aspect of not taking anything seriously, not being able to accept, for instance, a word like honor as a kind of tangible concept, because honor is a code, is an official ideology, which if you are isolated as someone who has to fight on the battlefield, this word, honor, this concept will not do you any good once it comes to fighting for your life, or indeed running for your life. And part of the comedy here is that Falstaff later, he even plays dead, embodies a dead person in order to escape actually being killed in the battle. So this is a brief dialogue he has with Prince Henry before the battle begins. Right, he says basically that honor is merely a sign. It's not something that you can actually feel. The one who has honor is the man who died on last Wednesday in battle. Does he feel it? No. Right? Will it last? No, because there will be people saying bad things about him, detracting from him. So Falstaff is unwilling to accept this official code of his time. The chivalric code is no longer viable in a modern a world dominated by history in the sense of political scheming and strategic thinking and acting. Central characters and their performative appeal, like Falstaff in Henry IV, can dominate a play to the point where the representative or representational content can be neglected or can even be destroyed. Similar things happen with John Cleese as Petruchio in the BBC version of The Taming of the Shrew. Those in my Shakespeare's Comedies class, or also the current Shakespeare lecture I teach, have seen extracts from this. It can also happen with superior actors in the role of Hamlet, who can dominate a production to the detriment of the rest of the ensemble and the entire play. Orson Welles, as Falstaff, keeps asserting his real identity as a performer, imposing theatricality onto history. There are a few dialogues, which I can't show for reasons of time, where Jeanne Moreau, who plays Mistress Quickly, refers to... that's in the Shakespeare text, where Falstaff is called a whoreson, and Jeanne Moreau, being French, doesn't really pronounce the H, so she says Orson, like Orson Welles, right? Welles, as Falstaff, keeps asserting his real identity as a performer, imposing theatricality onto history and even imposing himself onto Shakespeare's plays. Obviously, the medium of film makes it easier to achieve this single focus on a character. Welles makes us see the historical events mainly through Falstaff's eyes, whereas in the play or in the plays, he is a minor character, though an important one. Falstaff is constantly looking for roles in which to display his histrionic genius, his constant readiness for drama. In this extract that you've seen, he says, "What shall we be merry? Shall we have a play extempore?" So he's constantly ready to play theater. And on the battlefield, as I said, he even plays dead in order to escape being killed by a ferocious Scotsman. The only necessity he bows to is food and drink, and perhaps, but definitely to a lesser extent, also sex. However, if representational ideology becomes simplistic or boring, total, complete theatricality becomes empty or runs the risk of becoming empty. If nothing else, age and aging don't go together with Falstaff's antics very well. Falstaff himself, sometimes aware of his age, he says, "I am old, I am old," sometimes drops the theatrical bravado. The play Henry IV, indicating the difficulties of drama by its sheer undramatic length, breaks up into two parts. Neither representation nor theatricality are able to exploit and sustain the dramatic potential for very long. So this is my final point. However entertaining and deep Shakespeare's plays may be, they are thus exposed to the double vulnerability of both representation and performance. In the comedies, the vulnerability loses some of its urgency because it is or may be neutralized in and through laughter. Even so, the more wildly performative transformations reach out, for example, the different games in the wood in Midsummer Night's Dream, in which everything seems possible for a while, the more wildly these performances look, the poorer a representative conventional ending may appear. In the long run, theatre has to choose between two fairly unsatisfying alternatives. Representation, on the one hand, which can easily slip into simplicity and boredom, or empty spectacle, on the other hand. So, entertaining and profound though they may be, there is this double vulnerability, but the media conditions of Shakespeare's time allow them to mediate to a large extent successfully and effectively between the Scylla of representation and the Charybdis of performance. Our modern picture of Shakespeare in performance may be distorted by reading the texts too much as literature, and also because we watch the plays in our types of theater as a cultural or, worse, educational institution. So if you only remember one thing from this lecture, it should be this, that the theater business in Shakespeare's time was not a serious institution of civic, urban, high culture, but a highly volatile and risky enterprise, indeed a cutthroat entertainment industry, much like Hollywood is today. Shakespeare and his fellow actors depended on box office earnings. He could not anticipate the value or values that later generations would assign to his writings. To sum up, I hope to have offered you a glimpse of recent developments in Shakespeare studies after the new historicism and cultural materialism, which, as you have seen, do not constitute a too clean a break with older forms, but some aspects are taken up and developed further. I've tried to explain, somewhat paradoxically perhaps, both the historical uniqueness, and the lasting universal impact of Shakespeare through the historical media conditions of his time and his ability to escape the limitations of these conditions, at least to some extent, and thus to prepare his work for completely different spatial, cultural, and media environments. One could argue that Shakespeare's plays could only come into being under certain historical conditions, social and cultural, which applied in Elizabethan and Jacobean England, but also that they cannot be exhausted by and in these conditions. They have been and are still being treated as raw material, exploited for all kinds of needs. They are also, since the 19th century, studied, read, and interpreted as sacred, inviolable texts, something they certainly were not when they were written and first performed. In other words, with Shakespeare, we have one of the best instances of the unstable media status of the theater, divided between entertainment for the moment and the sustained efforts of reading and studying something called literature. And looked at from, or in terms of media, film may now be a more suitable media configuration for continuing Shakespeare's stage life. Thank you very much. I would be glad to take questions.